I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. At least it looks like The Connection. But I'm here all alone, and there's no one behind the glass wall of the studio. Wait a minute, it's not a glass wall, it's... There's water in there. The room's filling up. My clothes are going to get wet. Wait a minute, I'm not wearing any clothes. Everyone's left. I'm here all alone. I'm somehow trying to swim, and I can't. What's going on? What's going on?
Awake. Shake dreams from your hair, my pretty child, my sweet one. Choose the day and choose the sign of your day, the day's divinity. First thing you see.
Work dreams, sex dreams, anxiety dreams, those well-remembered and forgotten dreams, they are a part of all our lives. And while as humans we are into our third or fourth millennia trying to figure out what they mean, neuroscientists and psychologists are making substantial progress in figuring out not what, but why we dream. This hour we dip our frontal lobes in the latest research and explore some of the theories and science that's currently examining why we dream and what our dreams do. Well, we need your help. What are dreams to you? Do they have a purpose? Or are they like random and vivid flashes of imagined or remembered images? And do you think your dreams affect your waking life? Or is it the other way around? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting our conversation today with Andrea Rock. She's a science writer with a new book called The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. She's joining us from a studio in New York. Hi, Andrea.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. You began your work on this book with a pretty basic question and found that scientists don't even agree on what a dream is.
That's right. There's been a lot of argument about how we dream and when and why through the ages. And it really wasn't until the 1950s when a graduate student at the University of Chicago wired his sleeping 8-year-old son up and recorded his brain waves that we realized that, in fact, every 90 minutes, the brain, while we're sleeping, shifts into high gear and becomes just as active as it is when we're awake. And it's during this phase that most, though not all, of our most vivid, complex dreams occur.
And so, Andrea, really, if there's a definition of a dream that we should use on the program, what would it be?
Well, in the book, I use an experience that can be recalled in waking consciousness, because there really is quite a broad spectrum of definitions. But for most people, I think the dreams that they recall are going to be those dreams that are have a bizarre, though probably complex plot, and are peopled with characters like some kind of crazy movie. And those are the dreams that more often occur during that regular period of sleep that occurs, rapid eye movement sleep.
I was surprised to find out that when you started talking to the experts, you discovered that there is, in fact, less sex in dreams than I thought, less of the Freud, more of the joy and less of the anxiety. It wouldn't have been the way that I sort of drew the categories.
Well, there is Freud has been vindicated on a couple of scores regarding his theory. We discovered it really wasn't until the mid to late 1990s that we discovered that, in fact, the portion of the brain that really goes into high gear during this vivid period of dreaming is, in fact, the center of the brain that directs our emotions and that is responsible for processing emotionally charged memory. So Freud was right in the sense that dreams can give us a window on what our emotional preoccupations are, but there is far less sexual content. When they do content analysis studies of dreams, they find, you know, no more than 30% contain sexual content. But they are emotionally driven, and the meaning that's there to be interpreted really is on the surface. They don't have to be decoded. I mean, under Freudian theory, dreaming of your teeth falling out meant symbolized castration. And a Chinese dream book would tell you, oh, it means that the dreamer's parents are in danger. So that whole, you know, tendency to want to rely on these one-size-fits-all dictionaries for interpreting dreams don't make a lot of sense based on recent evidence.
I should also remind our listeners that that's not the direction we're going in the program today. So if you have your favorite dream and you want to give us a call, I suggest you you take a look at one of these manuals that will guide you through what different experiences mean. In this program, we're talking about why it is we dream and what we can learn about ourselves from those dreams. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Deirdre Barrett is joining the conversation now. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, who's done a lot of research on the effect of trauma on dreams. She is editor of the journal Dreaming and author of a number of books on the subject, including The Committee of Sleep and Trauma and Dreams. Deirdre, thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, nice to be here.
I understand that your own ideas of what dreams might be began with the sort of random flashes of images that might not that be that easily stitched together, but you've come a long way from that.
Yes, I certainly believe that dreams are very meaningful, perhaps as meaningful as our waking thought.
Can you give us the example of the research that you did with the air traffic controller who saw American Airlines Flight 77 off on September 11th? That, to me, was the type of insight into the work that you're doing that taught me a lot about the way that we regard dreams today.
Yeah, that was an example in a paper that I did on dreams after 9/11. And I interviewed many of the people myself, but that one example I just found in a secondary source, but I thought it was really just the most beautiful kind of summary of what was going on for a lot of people. This was Danielle O'Brien, who guided Flight 77 out of Washington in what was just a very routine takeoff. And then an hour later, she was watching on the screen as it reentered Washington airspace and speeded toward the Pentagon and crashed into it. And she described to a reporter that she had recurring nightmares where she'd just wake up in the middle of the night completely reliving that exact experience of watching the control screen and seeing the plane and being helpless to stop it. But then eventually, as many people do, as they're beginning to come to terms with the trauma, if they don't have a lot of other complicating problems in their life, she had a dream that was very healing and resolved the nightmares for her, which was she dreamed that she saw a green pool that was also the radar scope, and that she just very gently reached into the pool and took the airplane, which was tiny, in her hand and just very gently stopped it. And she woke up and she felt much better and she stopped having the recurring nightmares and as much of the waking distress after that.
Which brings us to an idea that our brain is operating, this is the part, the hurdle that's high for me to get over, is kind of operating independently here if in fact it's involved in the exercise of helping us overcome stress and trauma.
Yes, well, I believe that many parts of our brain operate independently of each other even while we're awake, that a very small part of what our brain is doing is actually in our consciousness. And you have the experience even awake of a problem that you haven't even been consciously thinking about. Suddenly the answer will pop into your mind, or just suddenly some memory, if an hour ago you were trying to think of a name and you couldn't, that some other part of your mind is working on that retrieval or that problem solving even while you go on about whatever your conscious mind is focused on. And so I think many of those other aspects of our brain may come into the prominence more during dreaming stages. For one thing, we don't have to be monitoring our environment, simply balancing and watching out for moving objects as we sleep. So some of those other non-priority kinds of parts of our mind and thinking can be in the foreground.
Now, Andrea, you're a tough-minded science journalist, though. I get the the impression that you had the same kind of aha moment when you're studying this to discover just how busy your brain was when you weren't awake and you weren't really at the controls.
Exactly. It's learning about exactly what's going on in the brain while you're sleeping really changed my idea of how my brain works during waking consciousness. And I think some of the most interesting evidence of what's going on has to do with dreaming and other sleep stages' role in processing memory and taking from our daily experience what's important and what we're going to record and integrating that with our past experience.
You tell the story of Matthew Wilson and his rats and the rat dreams in the maze and the work that's been done over the last 3 or 4 years. Tell us how that works.
Well, there's some interesting theories about the evolution of the dreaming phase of sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, that it originated in animals as a means for processing important survival-related information offline, you know, as Deidre said, when we don't have to worry about being chased by the tiger. And in fact, the studies that Matthew Wilson did at MIT support that. He had done studies showing that when rats were learning during waking hours how to travel through a maze to obtain these little chocolate food rewards, the scientists were recording their pattern of brain cell firing as they were in the maze. And then later, when they were sleeping, they found that the rats were going through an exact mental rerun of that experience when they entered rapid eye movement sleep. And they can read that
on a graph? They can actually read the rat's brain going through exactly the same sequence?
Right. The match was so precise that they could tell when the rat was sleeping whether it was dreaming of, you know, running or being still, and in what portion of the maze it was. And there have been follow-up studies in humans, some of them also done by some of Deidre's colleagues at Harvard, looking at that same function of dreaming and various sleep stages in humans, processing memory. Musicians often say that when they're having trouble learning a new piece of music, if they come back to it after a couple of nights sleep, they'll suddenly have it down pat, even though they haven't practiced in the meantime. And so a lot of the experiments have shown now that there are various stages of sleep that are important for different purposes, learning new physical skills, helping in memorization.
If I can just turn back to Deirdre here in the studio. I'm wondering if how you see this, Deirdre, is our brain in effect going through the images collected in the last waking period, the day preceding perhaps, and saying, well, we'll keep this one and we'll keep this one, and filing them away in a kind of long-term memory bank. Is that part of what's happening with the dream?
Certainly memory processing is a big piece of what seems to be going on during dreams, and I think that those experiments illustrate it well. But dreaming seems to do many other functions of thinking and processing, and including some higher level ones. I mean, not only do musicians know the music better after a couple of nights of dreaming sleep, but composers will hear a brand new piece for the first time, wake up and write it down. And, you know, that's not a memory function. That's a very creative, higher order function. So I think that the proportions may be different, but that dreaming does almost all of the functions that we're trying to work on awake at various times.
So are we anywhere close to getting a handle on this, or are we still just sort of nibbling away at the edges of understanding what a dream is or why a dream is?
I would say that we're about as close as we are in waking thinking. There's a kind of funny dichotomy where some of the neuroscientists will discover what brain areas are doing during sleep or dreaming and say, therefore it causes it, and it's explained.
Right.
And sort of how it's operating biologically is explained, but you would never look at waking thinking and say, oh, okay, because we can see this amount of activity in this area of the cortex, that's why you dream, or that explains, you know, why we have waking consciousness.
I'm going to stop you there. We're going to come back after the break, talk more about the work of biochemists, specialists in artificial intelligence, microbiologists, neurophysiologists, all the people who are trying to figure out what's going on inside our heads when we sleep. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. In our hour talking about and thinking about and trying to figure out dreams, I have with me here in our Boston studio Deirdre Barrett. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and editor of the journal Dreaming. Andrea Rock is with us from a studio in New York. She's a journalist and author of a new book called The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll take our first call from Burlington, Vermont, and Martine is with us. Hi, Martine. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call. I lost my dad suddenly and tragically 10 years ago, and I have sort of a recurring dream where he comes home, sort of walking through a field and appears suddenly, and it's very real, and I wake up in the morning feeling peaceful and happy as if I had really spent time with him, And I was just wondering if this is a common phenomenon that we sort of bring people back to life in our dreams.
Does the dream change, Martine?
It does. Yeah, it does. But it always has the same ending, which is that it's happy and we're together again. And I get much more of a sense of closure than I had in real life when he died.
Deirdre, this sounds like your field of expertise.
Yeah, I did a study about 10 years ago collecting dreams from people who were bereaved. And what I found was similar to the more dramatic traumas, which was that right after the death, people were likely to have dreams that just recreated learning that the person had died or the moment of death and tended to be very unhappy. But
nightmares.
Well, or just very sad dreams sometimes. But that as time passed, the dreams usually became more pleasant. And sometimes if the person hadn't gotten to say goodbye to the loved one, the dream would be
provide that farewell,
get to say those things that they hadn't in waking life. Sometimes it would go back to an earlier, happier part of the relationship and relive that. Sometimes it would simply be the sense of their presence, what our caller is describing, of just being with that person. And then sometimes the dreams moved on to a stage where the lost loved one would tend to return to give good advice and comment on things going on in the present and sort of be incorporated as some wise part of the dreamer's self.
But in your analysis of this, what's in front? Who's driving this? Is this the Let's take Martine's example. Is this Martine, as a waking, thinking human being, gradually over time coming to terms with the fact that her dad is gone and her dreams are reflecting that? Or are the dreams, in fact, helping her, leading her in that direction by providing her with that kind of comfort? Do you see what I mean? Is it an image or a reflection?
Yes, well, I think in the case of Martine's dream, it's a little hard to tell. It's evolving over time, and very likely both her waking processing of this is contributing to having that dream, but the dream probably contributes to, you know, to her waking adjustment to her father being gone. But in some cases, you can really see that it is the dream producing it. The person will have been extremely upset about some loss or trauma until one dream, more like what Danielle O'Brien is describing there. And also, we've discovered that although this will happen spontaneously often, that you can teach people to alter dream content, where it's definitely the dream that's changing. You coach people on saying, the next time I have a nightmare about the World Trade Center collapsing on me, or I have that battle dream again, or I have a sad dream about, you know, that so-and-so's dead, that instead I want the dream to go somewhere else, do something else, change.
Andrea, is this the kind of lucid dreaming that you actually took part in researching the book?
Well, what Deirdre is talking about is more rehearsing a different ending to the dream.
But you did learn a way of sort of being aware of the fact that you were in a dream while you were in a dream, right?
Yes, and I had been very skeptical about that before it happened to me for the first time, even though I'd read lots of scientific evidence documenting that it happens. But it is, I think everyone's probably had that experience of just momentarily becoming aware that they're dreaming while the dream is still going on. But in a lucid dream, often what that does for most people is trigger an awakening. But in lucid dreaming, you can actually become aware that you're dreaming and then direct the course of the dream from that point forward. It's kind of walking a tightrope to keep dreaming and not wake up, but it's a fascinating experience.
Let's go to Carborough, North Carolina. Now Sam's joining us on the line. Hi, Sam. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. Great program as always. I have a question for your guest.
Yeah.
I seem to only remember a certain type of dream I have, and that's normally in form and content. It's first person. It's from my perspective. I know the people around me, and the ideas that are reflected are kind of ideas, emotional or anxious ideas that I've already considered, but they help me kind of understand my true feelings about a situation. Now, I'm wondering do I only remember a certain type of dream? And I have, because I talk to friends, and they have completely different dreams in both form and content. Now, do I have those dreams and I don't remember, or do different people have different dreams? And if I am only remembering a certain type of dream, how do I better remember all my dreams?
Well, that's a series of questions. And one can't be sure what else you may be dreaming, but different people do dream very differently. Some people are always their usual self. Some people change genders, dream their animals. Some people's dreams are much more bizarre and fantastic, and some people's are much more realistic. So probably, even if you had better dream recall, that more of yours would be that way than others. But for the question of dream recall, dream recall spontaneously varies a lot. Some people remember 5 dreams a night, some people just a few a year. But there are things that you can do to increase your dream recall. First of all, just getting plenty of sleep will increase your dream recall. Secondly, if you remind yourself, just as you're falling asleep, that you want to remember a dream and kind of picture yourself waking up from the dream. If you keep a pad and pen by the bed or a tape recorder so that you'll have something to record it promptly. And lastly, when you first wake up, either in the middle of the night or in the morning, don't just jump up and do something else. Dreams are very fragile in short-term memory, and if you turn your attention to anything else, they'll be gone. But if you lie there quietly and just think, if you have any sense of who you were with or where you were or something you were feeling, sometimes a rather elaborate dream will then come back that would be lost forever if you hopped up to brush your teeth or chat with somebody before you thought about it.
And Andrea, I noticed in one part of the book you describe dream research labs where people are woken up on, what is it, every 2 hours and asked to report?
Mm-hmm.
I would think that was awful.
Yes, one of them gave the researcher a little button that she had made for that said, "I had a dream, and I wish you'd let me finish it." But and what they found there is even people who are convinced that they don't dream are in fact dreaming during the night. But as Deidre says, if you don't make an effort to recall as soon as you wake up, it's usually gone.
1-800-423-8255 to Waltham, Massachusetts now. David is next. Hi, David. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Dick. Great show.
Thanks.
As always. First comment, although not the initial comment I wanted to call in, was lucid dreaming. I've been able to do that for a number of years now, and it wasn't any conscious effort on my part. But if I'm moving through a dream, I can both realize that I'm dreaming and redirect the outcome of the dream. And that's just an interesting side effect, and it occasionally can make dreams more interesting or more fun, but occasionally can lead to different avenues as well. But my main point was that I find that dreams can provide some real-life feedback for me specifically, in that I work in a marketing environment, high-tech software company, and occasionally I'm under a lot of stress to get things done, and I wind up having school dreams where I show up for class either naked or without preparing for the final or not having bought the textbook for the entire year. But usually it doesn't sort of freak me out in the dream, but when I wake, I realize I guess I am under a lot of stress, and I often talk to my wife about these dreams. She tells me, you know, you're having school dreams, something must be going on in real life that's causing you to worry about it. So I use that feedback as a mechanism to sort of take a deep breath and take stock of things that are outside of typically the work environment and say, hey, I've got a happy, healthy family, things aren't so bad. So I kind of use those dreams as feedback.
I'm going to expand it a little bit to people in my own office who, in anticipation of this program, were all trading stories about work dreams and wondering exactly, David, the same sort of thing. Does this mean that we're, too involved, too obsessed? I don't know how you see it, Deirdre.
Well, again, I really believe that we tend to be dreaming about the same things that we're thinking about awake, even though it's this different state that presents something a little bit different angle on that. And obviously, our jobs are something that are important to most of us. So many people have dreams literally about work. And then such a common metaphor for most people in our culture is being in school and taking exams, that anytime there's a stress in a current environment or sense that you're being judged, having an exam dream is common. Although when I interviewed actors for the Committee of Sleep, they told me that their classic dream was like showing up for an audition or a rehearsal or something and realizing that they'd forgotten to read the script or they'd come on the wrong day or
something.
So
did you end up collecting all these and concluding that maybe they are instructive? Maybe the anxiety dream that I'll appear in the studio and nobody else will be here or that is... is something, as David's saying, that I can take as useful or just random?
Well, I think sometimes, as David articulated very well, someone may not be all that aware of what's bothering them in their waking life until they have that dream and stop and say, why am I having the exam dream? They can be very useful in that sense. I think other times people who already know they're feeling stressed are having dreams that don't tell them much more than that. And then once in a while, rarer but more important, people have dreams where there's really a good and different solution to the work problem within the dream.
I want to, Andrea, go back into the sort of scientific research that you did in the book, because one of the things that we haven't talked about yet on the program is what's new and what is it that people, the sleep and dream researchers, can see about what's going on in our dreams that they might not have been able to see back in the 1950s. I mean, you made the point at one that after the discovery of REM sleep, there was a sort of golden era of dream research in the 60s, but with that, we're in a new one right now.
Yes, I think during that first golden era, one of the things we realized is that there was a very different operating environment in the brain during sleep in terms of the neurochemicals that are circulating, and that the predominant one is fosters kind of freewheeling associations. And then in the mid and late 1990s, when brain scanning imagery allowed us to really look at what areas of the brain were most active during dreaming versus waking consciousness, what they found was that the areas that are involved in emotional processing and memory were much more highly activated than they are during waking consciousness. So it appeared that area, the dreaming phase of sleep, seemed to be, at least in part, a time for processing emotionally charged experience. And so that there's more of research going on now to try to tease out what the differences are. And in fact, some recent experiments showing that in depressed people, the patterns of brain activation that are seen are exactly the opposite of people who aren't depressed, and that may explain why they tend to wake up in the morning saying they feel more down in the dumps than when they went to bed.
But it's still scratchy pen marks on a roll of paper. I mean, there's no way that the positron emission tomography scans or any of the fancy things that are now available to the scientists are giving them access to the images and the ideas in the head.
For that, you still have to rely on reports from the dreamer.
Right.
But there's efforts to really make some progress in that area, too, and to compare what you see in terms of what's going on in the head when a dreamer dreams of a specific image versus just imagines it in waking consciousness.
It's terrifying to think, though, that at some point, Deirdre, there would be this holographic projection of dreams. I mean, maybe great for a dream researcher, but intimidating
for
the rest of us.
It's a fantasy. So many films about dreams have one of those video screens where you just see the dream on film. We'd love it.
But you can see more, you can understand more based on the detail and the intricacy and the sort of nanobiomedics of the scanning now?
Yes. I mean, you can't literally read someone's mind awake or dreaming, but you can see things like movement areas lighting up, areas associated with calculation, areas associated with language. So you don't know exact content, but you know if somebody's having a lot of physical activity in their dream, or for that matter, in their waking imagery. All these same scanning effects apply there. There was a French researcher showed a film of a woman who was a professional dancer who happened to be dreaming about dancing. She was woken up and questioned slightly after. And you saw this amount of activity in the areas of her brain, much like when she danced. You could not have been sure that she was not doing jumping jacks or, something else. But you can begin to see some of that, and I'm sure it will get more sophisticated.
1-800-423-8255 to Brookline, Massachusetts now, and Lenore's with us. Hi, Lenore.
Hi. This is really a small question, but it may have repercussions or big answers. Are all the people in your dream really you, a reflection of you yourself? Because you're the one who initiates this work. So
if I dream of family members, Lenore, or colleagues at work,
or anybody.
Yeah, the question is, are they just reflections of how I see them, or is it something bigger than that?
Bigger than that. Not just how I see them. Are they really a part of me, myself?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether or not Deirdre can help you with that.
It's Carl Jung who was a real proponent of the idea that they're not even so much representations of that person as that they are parts of you. And other theorists tend to interpret them more as not literally that person, but of how you see that person. And, of course, there's certain religious beliefs that would suggest that, you know, the real person or some other entity communicating with you, you know, might be there. But I think that the Jungian idea is interesting, and often you understand more about yourself by thinking of it that way. But I wouldn't negate the idea that the dream character represents how you think of that person, or at times is a stand-in for someone else yet. I think you get the most by sort of wondering in this dream, what is this character representing? A part of me, that person and issues I have with them, or something more abstract yet. In the problem-solving dreams I collected, very often someone like Einstein would appear to, or John Nash to a mathematician, to tell the person the answer to a problem they hadn't been able to solve.
This is
awake.
A true story, and the mathematician ended up giving credit to Nash
yes.
in publishing
the
theory.
Right? I ended up seated next to Nash at a dinner party recently, and I was asking him about that, and he said, oh, yes, he'd been told about that at the time it occurred, and that he was just so charmed that even though clearly it was the other mathematician's work, that he kept thanking him and really acted as if, you know, the waking John Nash had done him a favor by appearing in this dream.
All right, Connection listeners, who's appearing in your dreams? No, don't answer that question. We're talking this hour about why we dream, what the latest in the science of understanding dreams is telling us. And our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK, and we're talking about sleeping and dreaming this hour on The Connection. We have with us Andrea Rock. She's written a new book called The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. Deirdre Barrett's also with us. She's written most recently The Committee of Sleep and also Trauma and Dreams. She is a PhD psychologist who studies dreams through interviews and dream journals. She's also editor of the journal Dreaming. We're going to go straight back to the phone lines, and this one is in Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael's with us. Michael, thanks for calling.
Hi. I had a dream about, I didn't have a dream, a question about how coherent dreams really are versus how much of it might be the waking brain trying to make sense of what happened.
Give me an example of what you mean.
Well, specifically, I've had dreams where, it seems perfectly coherent series of events, and it ends with something like a sound or something. And I wake up, and the sound actually exists in the real world, like someone knocking on the door or the sound on the radio. But it was in my dream, and what happened prior to the dream was perfectly coherent.
So it sort of flawlessly incorporated into the dream. It doesn't come in like an interruption.
Exactly. It's like the dream went there. It wasn't like suddenly in the middle of the dream there was a knocking on the door. It was almost like I was expecting someone to be at the door. I was waiting at the door, and they knocked, and there they were.
Which raises a fascinating question about sort of just basic narrative sequencing and whether or not we, you know, take those images and put them into a narrative order in order to make sense of them when we're trying to draw those dreams out. But maybe I'm getting ahead here, Deirdre, in terms of understanding where the sounds fit. Is this something that you look at?
Yes. Well, real stimuli seems to get incorporated rather indiscriminately from the ongoing imagery, especially if it doesn't come in so loud that it alarms us. There's a delightful example. Steve LaBerge, who's done most of the lucid dreaming research, at one point was experimenting with a soft tape recording saying, "Stephen, you're dreaming," played throughout the night to induce lucid dreams. And sometimes he heard it and realized that he was dreaming, but he recounted one dream where he was walking around his sleep lab which he, you know, is where he works every day.
So this was a dream that he was walking
around?
Yeah, a dream.
Okay. And the loudspeaker began to broadcast, "Stephen, you're dreaming. Stephen, you're dreaming." And he wondered, now, why is my sleep tape playing over the lab loudspeaker? And of course, he was asleep, and the tape was really playing as it was supposed to. But he incorporated this. Someone must have turned on the tape recorder, and it's coming over the lab PA system, and kept dreaming without realizing it was a dream.
Andrea, if I go back to what the experts were telling you about those different moments in the night when they can record the rapid eye movement and all that sort of thing, I've wondered, and it kind of links up with what Michael was asking, whether or not there's a difference between the dream at 2:30 in the morning and the dream that happens 3 minutes before the alarm clock goes off, which is a sort of classic dreaming moment for me.
Yes, as the night goes on, the studies have shown that those are periods of rapid eye movement sleep. Increase in length. I mean, in the early part of the night, they may be 10 minutes or so. They can be as long as 20 minutes to an hour toward morning. So they're longer. They're more. The dreams that you would have during that period would be more complex. And also, there have been a couple of studies showing that they incorporate memories that are further removed from your current experience. I mean, those are the ones where you may have your first grade teacher making an appearance or whatever. But also another point is that when you're talking about how the narrative is constructed, there is also interesting research showing that we have that kind of story spinner in our brain that's at work in waking consciousness too, where there's a part of the brain that tends to want to make sense of whatever it's presented with, whether it makes sense or not. So that's part of what's at work during dreaming also.
That, in fact, we might be constructing a narrative by looking for a way of linking together images which might in our dream not really be well connected?
Yeah, that there's some of that. I mean, sort of the summation of all of the research I looked at would say that, in fact, whatever it's the emotional concerns that you have that are driving the dream, as several of the callers have said, you know, an anxiety dream results in the brain forming what really amounts to a visual metaphor,
right,
to express that emotional concern. And in some cases, what's happening is that. And in some cases, you know, there's some random images that just get woven in, whether it's from some outside stimuli or not. But we have very creative brains that love to make sense and spin stories of whatever is presented.
All right. Thanks for that. To Hillsborough, North Carolina now, and Hollis is with us. Hi, Hollis. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. The reason I'm calling you is that I am an artist, and I have dreamed my work for many, many years since I was a child. And in the last 4 years, my dreams had always been in full color. And in the last 4 years, I've noticed a big difference because I've been dreaming in one color, like all red or all yellow. And every dream that I have like that for my work, because it eventually gets made into work, is a statement piece, whether it's about a social issue or an environmental issue.
Hollis, are you a painter or a photographer?
Well, I work in textiles, but
right.
My work is painted, and then it's got a tremendous amount of thread work on it.
I'm asking because I'm assuming there's a lot of color in the work that you do.
Yes, it was always very, very colorful, but in the last 4 years, it's really gone to all blue, and then it's got all the thread work in full color. But it's very interesting because I recently dreamed a forest that was red, and I wasn't quite sure why I dreamed it, and it was baobabs. I lived in Africa for many years. And then the funniest thing was, 2 or 3 months later, I dreamed why I dreamed it and how it related to being a statement piece.
Don't you love the brain, the way it does something, doesn't explain itself, and then will come back sometime later and attempt to try and explain what it wasn't explaining to you earlier? I mean, this is what makes it, I guess, kind of so hard to put your finger on.
Yes, I mean, that's another example of just the definitely higher level processes that are there, because when somebody sees something in a dream, likes the image and recreates it in art, whether the dream was presenting it for that purpose or not is somewhat in question. But when someone forgets the image and then has the same dream to remind them, or In the Committee of Sleep, I had a number of examples where somebody would dream an artistic inspiration and then dream some follow-up. In one case, a character appearing and explaining to the artist why she had sent her that dream, claiming to be the person who'd sort of designed the dream, which in that case, it was a very elaborate garment that a very like high art seamstress had dreamed. And
can you make sense of the color part of Hollis's question, though? Why things might appear in one color as opposed to in all the colors? Is there any precedent for that?
There's a lot of research on color versus black and white, or just plain unawareness of dreaming, which just seems to show that vivid color in dreams usually goes with a lot of measures of dream vividness: more dream recall, more bizarreness, more dramatic content. The same people that have a lot of sort of colorful in the metaphoric sense kinds of dreams have more color in their dreams in the literal sense. But in her case, I imagine she can tell better than I what, mm-hmm. What those colors mean for her or why now and why they're what she's thinking about.
Andrea, one of the things that clearly struck you in your own research, though, is the way that so many people would say that dream was so vivid, almost as if the colors and the images were bolder and brighter than they would have been in real life.
Yes. Well, I think one of the fascinating things, actually, before we leave the color thing, just to throw in one thing, there was an interesting thing that when they would do studies during the period when most films were in black and white, they would do studies asking people about their dreams, and the majority would report that they always dreamed in black and white. And then when color, became predominant,
right.
So anyway, part of it can be also a bias from waking consciousness too, about how we perceive the appearance of our dreams. But one of the things that was fascinating to me was to really understand that in waking consciousness, as in dreaming consciousness, we see with our brains, not our eyes, because you have no visual input from the retina when you're dreaming, yet the images that you're getting, which are drawn from memory, are and that you're composing from different bits of memory and putting together, feel every bit as real as in waking consciousness. And in fact, I, one of the most interesting people I talked to was a researcher who was blinded at the age of 25, and he talked about his dreams after being blinded, and that they've come to fill an important function for him, that the dreams he has that involve memories that occurred before he lost his sight have the same visual quality as waking, as the sight he had in waking life when he was fully sighted. But the other images that are coming from after he was blinded have a different quality, and that the dreams themselves that he has now are very important when he has to learn a new route to get to his doctor, if he changes his office. It's not until he dreams of walking on that route.
He gets that spatial understanding, yeah.
Right, that he's very confident. And so, that is still a very important part of his visual experience, his dream life.
1-800-423-8255, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen's with us. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks so much. Great show. So much of what you're talking about seems to really draw very heavily on the kinds of things discussed by Sigmund Freud almost 100 years ago and the interpretation of dreams. It seems like some of that influence still exists today, perhaps with somewhat different emphases. I really have two questions about the science. One is, you have different scientists that are bringing their thinking to bear, like artificial intelligence and neurosciences and biology and what have you. And I guess the question is, they have a lot more tools at their disposal today than Freud did in terms of data and in terms of measurement procedures. What kinds of unique contributions going beyond Freud do you think are being made with these new sciences attending to dreams? And secondly, these sciences themselves come from different cultures. They have cultures of research, they have standards of evidence and so forth. as these scientists are coming together, what does it take to be considered an important new contribution? What type of evidence is recalled for today versus, say, 100 years ago?
Andrea, I'm going to ask you to start off on this one, because these are some of the threads that you were holding together in the book. It's startling that as much of what Freud was thinking 100 years ago still remains with the science that we have today.
Yes, there are portions of it that certainly are supported by the science. I think the new what's not supported is the idea that everything in dreams is this elaborate system of symbols that needs to be decoded. But I think where we're going now that's new territory that's fascinating is really in very concrete scientific ways documenting the role that the dreaming stage of sleep and others acting in concert play in terms of learning and forming memories and consolidating memories. And there's work being done, as you said, in various places. I mean, a wonderful lab in Belgium that's set up to do functional magnetic resonance imaging solely for studying dreaming. So that's something new that should provide some very interesting evidence. And they're also looking on the level of microbiology. In fact, we really don't to this day understand fully why it is that we sleep, why we even need to sleep. And there's some interesting experiments being done now at the University of Wisconsin looking at that. And the initial answers appear to be that it may be as simple as we need to have a periodic break from the brain chemicals that are the predominant ones during waking consciousness.
I got a chuckle out of one part in your book, and I want to close with this, just hearing Deirdre's response to it, that the researchers saying that they still kind of have to make their grant applications saying we're doing sleep research rather than we're doing dream research, because dream research, Deirdre, still has that sort of, wait a second, what kind of work is this really? Is that something that you still contend with?
Yeah, I think those dream dictionaries, with the teeth falling out means this or that, and to some extent some of Freud's more outlandish statements really set the field back, so that even though the average person realizes that dreaming, is the most interesting and important part of sleep, it doesn't
talk to any group of six people.
Yeah,
nobody ever lost any interest
in that association.
I want to thank you so much for coming in to be with us on the program today.
Nice to be here.
Deirdre Barrett is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, editor of the journal Dreaming. And Andrea Rock, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. It was fun.
Andrea is a science journalist and author of The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.